welcome to the second part of our two-putter election special. I'm Jaden.
I'm Evan.
And I'm Armand. This episode contains the next three interviews of the two-part election special. That being said, we will not have a specific segment of just the three members of the Gradient podcast.
First off, we want to introduce Dr. Kritika Kupali, who's going to talk to us about voting under the coronavirus pandemic restrictions.
Take it away.
We are so happy to introduce the Vice Chair of the Infectious Diseases Society of America's Global Health Committee, Assistant Professor of Medicine Division of Infectious Diseases, Medical University of South Carolina, and passionate traveler, Dr. Kritika Kupali. Thank you so much for coming on the Gradient podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So our first question for you today is, before voting, what should be the first step that voters take to best ensure their safety in this pandemic?
That's a really great question. So before voting, the first thing voters should do is really check and ensure that they're registered to vote prior to Election Day. And they can do that at going to vote.org. And also they should check with their local elections officials to make sure there are no special instructions at their polling location. They can check for hours of voting. A lot of places are having extended hours. They're having early voting, so they can make sure that they can go early if they need to. And one of the things I keep telling people to ensure that voting is efficient is I would encourage them to look over their sample ballot and fill it out. That way, when they get to the voting booth, they can fill out the real ballot quicker and get through voting in a more efficient way.
So on November 3rd, when voters are going to their polling place in person to vote, what kind of precautions would you say they should take before going out to their polling places?
Well, so let's step back for a second. So really, Election Day has really changed this time around. We're calling it election month, right? So many places are having early voting. We've already had over 75 million people have already voted. So early voting is happening all over the place. So if you can vote early, please go vote early. And try to vote in an off-peak time, such as the mid-morning. If your locality offers it, go on the weekend because the lines might be shorter. I would be prepared to wait. Make sure that you take something to do while you're waiting in that line. Most importantly, wear a mask, take hand sanitizer with you, and make sure to perform appropriate physical distancing while in line. And many of those recommendations are recommendations I'm going to make for anyone who's going to go and vote on November 3rd. If you're going to go vote on November 3rd, again, fill out a sample ballot before you go. So it's going to make voting more efficient. Go early. Prepare to wait in line. Take food with you because you're going to get hungry. Prepare for changes in weather. So I would take a sweater or a jacket because you might get cold. Take water with you. And again, wear a mask, take hand sanitizer, and make sure to maintain your distance in line. Those are all gonna be really important things to keep yourself safe and also to entertain yourself while you're in line.
So you talked a lot about what voters can do when they go to vote, whether it be through early voting or whether it be through voting on election day. But what precautions and what are kind of the responsibilities of polling places and other voting institutions to help protect voters?
Yeah, so a lot of us who work in public health have spent a lot of time looking at this and making recommendations. And there's some things that we've put out there stating, you know, one of the things that people, elections officials can do is increasing the number of polling locations that are available. This will decrease the crowds that are happening on election day or in the early voting process. Also, moving polling locations to large, well-ventilated areas that can accommodate the physical distancing measures between individuals, between voting booths, and poll workers. They should also make sure that these larger sites have good ventilation systems. Some of the places that we've recommended are convention centers, large music venues, school gymnasiums, warehouses, and professional sports arenas. Also, if weather permits, they should really consider making sure that they're having check-in procedures outdoors. You really want to minimize the amount of time that people are spending indoors. We've also recommended that polling locations have supplies for healthy hygiene, and they're cleaning the site with an EPA-approved disinfectant prior to opening the site, and then also high-touch areas such as doors, voting booths, and reusable items are being routinely disinfected. This will also help protect not just voters, but also poll workers that are working on election day.
We have seen an amazing output of teens volunteering to become poll workers. Are these younger poll workers at a higher risk of contracting COVID-19, and how can they help mitigate that possibility?
Well, so I want to be clear. Every individual is at risk for COVID-19. However, what we know from the data that we've seen already is younger individuals are less risk for severe disease. There's still a lot we don't know about the transmission dynamics of the disease and why younger people don't appear to be getting as severe disease as older people. So we recommend that all individuals use appropriate precautions, the things that we've been talking about for months, right? So good hand hygiene, that they wear a face mask that covers their nose and their mouth and sits flat on their face, and that, again, they use good physical distancing. We're also recommending that there are plexiglass barriers that check in that separates the poll worker from the voters, and also that all poll workers have access to free testing. So those are all things that can be done to help mitigate the risk for everybody. We don't want our older population to be poll workers, again, because they have the comorbidities that we've seen that put them at higher risk for developing more severe disease and then being at risk for fatalities from COVID-19.
And I just want to quickly follow up on that. You talked about all the possibilities that poll sites can do to help mitigate the spread of COVID-19, but that's not always necessarily possible. What do you think the impact of COVID-19 or will have on the election, or the impact of the election on the spread of COVID-19?
Well, I think that's, hard to know. I think one of the things that we've seen so far is, we're doing things that are helping, right? So we've instituted a lot of measures to try and help spread out voting in this early voting period, mail-in voting. We've already had 75 million people who have voted as of today, which is wonderful. So we really need to try and recommend people to take their health and their safety in their own hands. Yes, we have all these recommendations out there for the polling locations to do things, but really, again, if people can use good hand hygiene, wear a face mask. We know that wearing a face mask in and of itself can decrease the risk of you transmitting or getting COVID up to 85%, and maintain physical distance. So if you're in line and there are people around you, try and ask them to maintain your physical distance. You yourself should be proactive as well in doing the things that you can to help protect yourself. So that's very important.
So some recent reports have shown that there are many voters who are expressing concerns and a level of unwillingness to vote due to the pandemic. So what message do you have for these people who are expressing voter apathy because of the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, that is something we have been concerned about. And the one thing I will say to all those voters is, first of all, I completely understand your fears and your concerns, and understand why you would be scared to go out and vote. And the only thing I can say is that the only way things will change is that if you go out and exercise your right to vote. Our democracy depends on every single citizen voting, and I urge every citizen to vote. If you're scared to vote in person on election day, then please look at the options in your area. Look and see, is there a way that you can still get a absentee ballot and drop it off in a ballot box? See if there's an option for you to do curbside voting. See if there's an option for you to do early voting. I can't say what the options are in place to place, but look at your local elections websites for those alternatives. Go to vote.org and see what those options are. Things are different in every place, and really the only way things will change is that if you go and vote.
So throughout many candidates at all levels of government and throughout their campaign, COVID-19 has definitely been a big issue to vote for them. So for voters, how important should voting for a candidate that has a good COVID-19 policy be going into this election?
Well, obviously COVID-19 has been the story of the year, and COVID-19 is affecting everything. It's affecting healthcare, it's affecting the economy, it's affecting racial issues. Racial and ethnic disparities are coming to the forefront of the COVID-19 pandemic. The health of our economy depends on the health of our population. And so we need to have a candidate that has a plan. We need a national plan. We are starting to see really the third peak really of our first wave. We never got our first wave under control, and that's from the beginning of the year. Then we had a second peak, so to say, in the summer, and now we're seeing cases go up again. And we really need to develop a good, strong plan as a country. And I think that it's important for people who are going to vote to really look at both of the candidates that are out there and see, you know, what do you think of their plan? What do you think of their policies, and evaluate for themselves what they think is best for this country going forward? Because the next 4 years are going to be extremely important. We are at a turning point in this country, and how we manage the pandemic is going to define really not just the 4 years, but really the direction our country goes.
One final question for you. So for teens voting for the first time in this election, and we are in circumstances that these teens haven't really seen before. So what advice do you give to teens going into this election and going into future elections?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So teens really have a wonderful opportunity. This is your opportunity to shape our country now and our future. There are so many topics at hand, right? Healthcare, the pandemic, the economy, racial and ethnic disparities, gender issues. There's just so many topics at hand. And, you know, what there's a saying that I really have had ingrained in my mind for a very long time in my life by Gandhi, which was, be the change you wish to see in this world. So for teens out there, voting is your power to change the world and shape the future. With so many critical issues at stake now, more than ever, you can't afford to sit on the sidelines. So please go out and vote. This is your chance to make a difference. So please go out and vote. Don't sit on the sidelines. Have your voice heard. Make a difference. Make a change.
So, Dr. Kupali, thank you so much for coming on and giving this opportunity to us to interview, but just to teens to really better understand this coronavirus and election perspective. And I think it's really important and really valuable to all teens that they've been given this opportunity. So before you go, is there anything you'd like to say to the people watching the Gradient Podcast?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on. This is a really great opportunity. I'm so glad to be able to speak to you guys are the future of our country, and I really hope that anything I say helps inspire you and helps motivate you to make a change in our country. You guys are the future of our country, so this is very exciting for me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming on the Gradient Podcast. Thank you so much for the interview, Dr. Kritika Kupali. Your words really shed insight on how to properly vote safely and accurately during the coronavirus pandemic.
But unluckily for voters, there's more than one thing trying to make voting harder for them for this year. More than ever, we see more attempts of voter suppression against voters. And here to further enlighten us on this issue, we have professor at Berkeley University, Bertrell Ross.
All right, and now on the podcast, we have a very special guest. Chancellor's Professor of Law at the UC Berkeley School of Law, voter suppression expert, and a proud member and supporter of the working class, Professor Birchall Ross. Welcome. How are you today?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here with you all.
All right, that's fantastic. So I'm going to go ahead and start with the first question. So a study by the Pew Research Center on August 2nd of this year found that 49% of all voters believe that they will have difficulty voting in this election. As voter suppression continues to make participating in our democracy more difficult, what should people look for when they're trying to identify these barriers in place?
Yeah, I think what you need to be looking for in terms of these barriers are three sets of things. You know, first you need to look at the laws and what are the laws on the books that set the qualifications for your voting. You know, there have been new laws that have emerged over the past half decade, couple decades that require, for example, that you have an ID in order to vote. Now, this didn't used to be the case in most states, and now it's the case in more than a majority of states. And so looking to see what those qualifications are that are necessary to vote are critical, because these new laws that have emerged have been designed to disenfranchise a set of voters, those voters who do not have voter IDs, do not have the resources to obtain one. Another thing that you need to be looking for is what are the means and mechanisms for voting and how they have changed, how have they changed? Now, the pandemic has produced a lot of challenges to voting in terms of changing the nature of voting more towards mail-in voting versus in-person voting, which has been our tradition in most states. And there are a lot of rules that go along with these new ways of voting. You have to sign your name to the back of these voting forms. In some states, you have to have an envelope sleeve to cover a particular portion of the vote of your ballot. There are different sort of rules. You have to drop them off at a particular place or mail them in at a particular time or have them be received. And it's changes to these laws and adjustments to these laws that can have suppressive effects. For example, a law that's in place that might allow voters to submit their ballot by mail on election day, so that's postmarked by election day, those can be repealed and rejected in favor of laws that don't allow you to mail your ballot on election day, that be received by election day. So these are types of rules in place in terms of the ways of voting that can have a suppressive effect. The final thing, though, that has a suppressive effect that I'm the most worried about is disinformation and intimidation. So the disinformation and misinformation that has been a problem with our elections in the past, this election seems to be focused on confusing people about how to vote, confusing people about where they can vote, confusing people about the sort of the fraud that might be associated with a certain way of voting. And then you combine that with the fears that people might have about voting absentee because of this misinformation leads them to vote at the polls. Then they get to the polls and they're confronted by folks that are trying to intimidate them, to deter them from voting. Those are all sort of part of the suppression tactic playbook that I'm worried about, and I'm seeing a little bit of evidence throughout the country.
So I would like to know, is there a segment of the population more frequently affected by voter suppression?
Yeah, so it's people of color, often African-American voters, Latino voters. They're also young people, people on college campuses that are often deterred from voting and for which there's efforts to suppress their votes. And then there are also the poor, for whom there have been a lot of efforts to suppress their vote. So these are the demographic categories that have historically faced different forms of voter suppression that are coming to play in this election as well.
So another question is, I don't think it's enough for people, you know, to just know that voter suppression exists. What I think is arguably more important and what, you know, more people deserve to know is, why do these people in power want to suppress our vote in the first place?
Yeah, so the goal of elections is to win, right? And, you know, it's seen as a way to win. What we saw in the 19th century, in the late part of the 19th century, when the Democrats were engaged in voter suppression tactics in the South, was that they recognized that these newly freed slaves in the South represented a threat to their ability to win elections. So how do you sort of address that threat? Well, you could try to appeal to these African-Americans and try to get their support, or you could try to suppress them. And what they chose is to try to suppress their vote. And they did so successfully, disfranchising most African-Americans throughout the rest of the 19th century and much of the 20th century. What we're seeing now is a Republican Party who has decided that their best path to election is to suppress a segment of the population's vote. The Republicans have tended to rely on a shrinking part of our electorate in order to win elections, and that shrinking part of our electorate is no longer a majority of our electorate. So if you're not seeking support, if you don't have support from a majority of the electorate, as it stands, then a way for you to win election is to suppress your opponent's support so that your supporters will still win elections even though they don't represent a majority of the electorate. So it's part of our winner-take-all politics that we're seeing take over in the last several decades, but it's been part of our history, that voter suppression tactics arise.
So for voters who are witnessing voter suppression, you specifically mentioned the Republican Party using these voter suppression tactics. What impact do you think this has had on the support for these political parties?
You know, I think it's actually, you know, worked to the disadvantage of the Republican Party in the long term and maybe even the near term too. You know, I think the thought is for any individual election in the short term, suppressing enough votes in a close state will allow them to succeed in that particular election. And this may have worked in 2016. We don't have sort of definitive evidence, but there is some suggestive evidence that Wisconsin, a state that had voter ID laws in the 2016 election, might have gone for Trump because of those voter ID laws, those voter suppression tactics through law. But in the long term, what they have is a backlash effect. It makes people angry. It makes people frustrated that a particular political class is seeking to take away their vote. And it may lead them to react with greater fervor and greater interest in voting than they would have had if there were no efforts to suppress their votes. So what I think that you're creating through voter suppression efforts is a class of voters who now have taken it personally that you're trying to take away their vote and are going to activate in response to those efforts to take away their vote. And I think you're seeing a little bit of that in Georgia right now, where African American voting is extraordinarily high in response to suppression efforts in the past by the Republican Party. You're seeing a bit of that in Florida as well, and in other states throughout the country.
So nowadays, what are some of the most prominent examples of voter suppression?
Yeah, so one of the most prominent and most visible forms of voter suppression that we might see more of on Tuesday is the efforts to intimidate voters at the polls. So what you do is you hire these election observers who are ostensibly there to protect the integrity of the election. But interestingly, and not coincidentally, they are often placed in polls in minority communities. And so these are folks that try to present a police type of image to the voters and try to sort of deter them and scare them or intimidate them to prevent them from voting. So that's something I am sort of particularly on the watch out for coming up this Tuesday, because it's particularly concerning because in several states you can bring guns to the poll, right? And having someone who's armed at the poll, even if they are forced to be a certain distance from the poll, can be frightening for voters, right? It can be scary. In this particular time, when we're so polarized and there's the fear of social disorder, you know, having that presence at the poll is quite intimidating. But another thing that is very prominent right now are misinformation and disinformation campaigns. Efforts to, again, confuse voters, to intimidate them from voting through information campaigns that suggest that if you vote, you know, there's going to be problems, right? You're going to have problems, right? There's something bad that's going to happen to you. We had a landlord in Colorado who has threatened to double the rent if Trump loses, right? These are sort of efforts that are designed to suppress the vote that I'm looking out for both private and public and official forms of intimidation, either through information or through presence at the polls.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the in-person intimidation that we've seen. So I'm sure I'm sure you've been made aware that, like, there are videos that are coming out on social media of people going to early vote where they're being practically like surrounded by people who are looking to intimidate other voters in support of a certain candidate. So I want to ask, has there really been any historical precedent for the amount of in-person physical intimidation we've seen for this election?
Not in a while, right? We thought as a country we had moved past this form of voter suppression, right? Other forms of voter suppression persist and exist and they're problematic, but this is the particularly dangerous form of voter suppression because of the social disorder that can arise from it. We hadn't seen this form of voter suppression since the late 19th century and the tactics by Southern Democrats to suppress the African-American vote in states throughout the South. Now we're seeing it arise again in states throughout the country as means to deter people from voting. Now they're not trying to eliminate the vote of an entire community, which is what Southern Democrats were trying to do in the late 19th century, but they're trying to deter enough people from voting so that they can secure the necessary margins to win the election. This is this is new in terms of, or this is kind of a return or a revival of forms of voter suppression that, again, we thought were in our past and unfortunately seem to be, again, a part of our present.
Voter ID laws are often justified as a combatant to voter fraud. Though how big of an issue is voter fraud really? And do these laws do more harm than good?
Yeah, so fraud in terms of separating out two sort of notions or two aspects of fraud. There's the actual fraud and there's the perception of fraud. Actual fraud is actually very rare. There's very, very few instances of in-person impersonation fraud, very few instances of absentee voter fraud. And so few that, you know, none of these forms of fraud have made any different in any election in recent history. But the challenge is the perception of fraud. Even though there hasn't been much, and even though fraud has been very rare, one party has felt that it's in their interest to promote this idea that there has been considerable amount of fraud and has created a perception of fraud amongst an important segment of the American people. And that perception of fraud undermines the integrity and legitimacy of elections in the minds of these voters, especially if their candidate does not win. And this perception of fraud and this undermining of legitimacy and integrity can then create the problems of social disorder that might arise after an election if the election doesn't go a particular way. So that is the kind of insidious effect of fraud and the perception of fraud on our electorate. Now, voter ID laws were intended to be sort of a tool that are designed to remedy or address problems of fraud, and they are in place in many states, and I would argue that their main effect has been to disfranchise, not to correct for fraud, because fraud has been so rare. Now, these voter ID laws are being overcome through different activities of nonprofit groups that are designed and focused on providing individuals with the resources and the means to obtain a voter ID, but there are still individuals who lack the voter ID who will not be able to vote in this election, who are being disfranchised on the basis of an argument of fraud that doesn't comport with reality.
So people most often hear about these attempts to suppress voters that happened across the country, and it can be very discouraging, which is unfortunate because a lot of the voter apathy that we see from voter suppression is sometimes indirect, where people don't want to vote because of their experiences with voter suppression, which honestly is disheartening because of that's exactly the goal of voter suppression. So to all voters, what is the solution to this issue and how can they work to achieve it?
You know, it's a difficult position for voters, right? Voters, again, often don't have the information that they need to be able to understand the process of voting and not to be misinformed and confused by disinformation and misinformation campaigns. So I think what we need to help voters do is to provide to identify sources of information that will give them valid information about how to and where to and what the consequences are of voting. We need to sort of eliminate or reduce the fear that people have that are exacerbated by these different voter suppression tactics. And again, I think it's up to the public, I think it's up to nonprofit groups to support the American people, and particularly those who are most prone to voter suppression, which are low income and minority and young voters. We need to make sure that they have the means and the tools and the capacity to understand, you know, what, where, and how, and the logistics of voting, and not to be misled by these disinformation and misinformation campaigns. And then I guess a final thing I would suggest to voters is recognize that their vote matters, and it matters a lot, because it's not simply the fact that they are fearful of voting and therefore suppressed, but fear combined with a sense that their vote does not really matter leads them to just say, why would I deal with any issues or problems associated with voting? Why would I sort of deal with the harm and costs associated with voting? I'll just stay home. But if people understand that their vote really matters, their voice is critical to have in the system. We need young people actively engaged, because we need their voice to shift this country in a different direction so we can address the many problems that are going to affect young people in the future. That we need racial minority, we need low-income voters to be a part of the conversation so that we can address issues of inequality. Once we sort of convey that notion that their vote matters, I think that that will lead them and create the sense of courage and resolve to fight through voter suppression efforts.
If one feels like their vote has been infringed on, what steps can they take forward, and what resources are there available?
So there are different groups that are engaging in election protection, right? So one of the things I would do, and it depends on what state you're in, but Googling election protection and then putting your state in that Google search to identify different hotlines for that will connect individuals to lawyers, to officials that will give them a sense of or answer their questions and resolve any confusions that they might have. There's also, in addition to election protection hotlines, there's vote.org. There's different Secretary of State offices in the state that will give them the truthful and complete information about the logistics of voting and help them respond to any sort of voter suppression tactics. I think it's important to sort of have these resources at hand. You can look these up on your phone, you can look them up on your computer, whatever it might be. Write down these numbers and call and contact individuals if you are facing any difficulties or issues with voting. And there will be people that are extraordinarily interested and concerned about this issue that will respond, and hopefully, and I think, will provide the individual with the information that they need to be able to vote confidently going forward.
So, not just to teens, but moreover to all voters worried about voter suppression impacting them, simply, what advice do you have for them?
I think the advice I have for them is to remember why they want to suppress your vote, right? The reason why they want to suppress your vote is because they want to deny your voice as being a part of the conversation in our political process. Once you recognize why, then I think that should instill within you the confidence and sense that your voice does matter. If individuals, political parties, candidates are going to make so great of effort to suppress your vote, right, that should build within you the resolve to understand that your vote does matter. And so again, my advice to particular individuals is to keep pushing through. Verify any information that's given to you by people you do not know. Right, whether it's a phone call, whether it's a social media post, whether it's Facebook, verify those things with official sources that are provided either through different sort of voting websites in the state, whether it be the Secretary of State's office, vote.org, or whatever it might be, or through different other forms of information that you might have that have been sent to your home through the mail. But verify with official sources any information that you receive to make sure that it actually is truthful information. And a final thing I would say, and this probably doesn't need to be said, but in a world in which absentee ballot is perhaps the most prominent form of voting, these days do not give your ballot to anyone you do not know. There have been efforts in Arizona, for example, by people who have gone to people's houses to say that they'll deliver their ballot to the ballot box, and that hasn't been the case. These individuals are engaging in nefarious fraudulent practices, and so make sure that you are the person who's putting the ballot in the box. You are the person who is giving it to a person that you trust to take it to the ballot box, and then complete and make sure you read all of the instructions on your absentee ballot. Right? Make sure you have your signature on there. Make sure you're delivering it to the right place. Try to get it to a Dropbox at this point, because the post office is not likely to deliver your mail in time for it to be counted if it needs to be received by Election Day. So go to the Dropbox yourself. And then finally, for those who are going to the polls, who are voting in person, right? Remember that these individuals are not official people. These are people that are engaging in sort of different intimidation tactics, but they have no right, no authority, no capacity to remove you from the line. They have no authority, no basis for blocking your vote. You should just stay in line, no matter how long the line is. Make sure your voice is heard and ignore all of those efforts to intimidate you at the polls.
So, Professor Ross, thank you so much for coming on. And as busy as, you know, this election month has been, and we really do appreciate you taking your time to come speak to us and, you know, voters and teens, just to inform them of this really important issue. So,
yeah, well, I thank you for having me on. It's wonderful to be here with you, and I appreciate the work that you all are doing to inform your audience.
So before you go, is there anything you'd like to say to the people watching the Gradient podcast?
I just say that, you know, keep faith in our democracy, right? The democratic project is fragile. It's always subject to disruption and distortion. But we have seen pretty bad days in our democracy, and we will see some in the future. But we have persevered, we have survived as a nation, and we will survive this particular election as well. So I would say, just as a final note, keep the faith and maintain the courage to continue this democratic project.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Ross. We really do appreciate you pointing out this injustice that happens in America and teaching voters how to identify it, but also fight it in the future.
Dr. Ross spoke heavily on the importance of election protection. That being said, we are so happy to introduce our next guest, Onika Williams, who shares her perspective on the front line of voting.
Take it away.
Thank you, Jaden. Next up, we have the chair of the National Bar Association Young Lawyers Division, Volunteer for Election Protection, a nonpartisan coalition that provides a national hotline for voters, and former Walt Disney World Rescue Ranger, Onika Williams. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be with you today.
We're honored to have you.
Thank you.
So let's just get straight into it. So what I think is most impressive about your story as a lawyer is the time you've devoted into actually helping others. And whether through being the co-president of the Feminist Law Forum or as the Enlightenment Chair for Black Law Student Association, for the Black Law Student Association, but now you're kind of on the front line trying to help voters with election protection. So walk us through how that's been.
Sure. So I am actually from Homestead, Florida. So I went to school in Dade County. And it is interesting because I was actually in the 12th grade in AP government during Bush v. Gore. So I was a few months shy of being able to vote in 2000. So I'm a little older than you. But fast forward 20 years, here we are in 2020. And I'm the chair of the National Bar Association Young Lawyers Division. And so the National Bar Association was founded in 1925 and is the oldest and largest national network of Black attorneys and judges. And the Young Lawyers Division is the home of the young lawyer. And so we are either under 40 years old or within 10 years of work experience. And so during this time, as you know, we're in a pandemic. We also just completed technically the 2020 census, which only happens every 10 years. And now we're in the 2020 election. Many places have started early voting. Many places have allowed their mail-in ballots to start being returned. And so this is a time where people like me, young lawyers and lawyers across the country, are finding ways to help. And one of the best ways that you can help during the election is to work as a hotline worker on the Election Protection Hotline. So the Election Protection Hotline actually began after the 2000 election. And as you mentioned, it's nonpartisan. The hotline literally just helps people vote. And so we answer questions for voters that may be in line or may be preparing to vote, just to make sure they're able to cast their ballot.
So you are among the 27,000 lawyers that volunteer with Election Protection. And so what concerns are most common among the voters that you have personally spoken with?
Sure. So I recently just started volunteering. As you've probably read, the Election Protection Hotline, which is run by the Lawyers Committee, is a year-round hotline that you can call for assistance. And so in these past few weeks, the callers that have requested help have called in to either find out where their polling place is or what time their polling place opens or closes. Several have wanted or needed to track their ballot. So people are literally just trying to make sure that they're able to vote, their votes count. We do, however, if there are more urgent issues, there is a way that those issues get escalated. So the election protection, there are several different ways that you can volunteer. I'm just a hotline worker. I'm actually training to hopefully be a captain by election day so I can help hotline workers. But there are also attorneys that file litigation. So something may happen. For example, you may remember a few months ago in Kentucky, there was a polling place that closed early, and litigation was filed to make sure that polling place was reopened. So you may have attorneys, and will likely have attorneys, that will be working real time to file litigation during election day to either reopen a polling place or extend the hours of a polling place. And then we also have field workers. Those are people who are on the ground that are helping to see and make sure that there are no issues at different polling places. So there are several different ways to volunteer. I would say probably, I'm not sure, the most common way is probably the hotline that you probably have read about and have been hearing about. So that's the 866 Our Vote.
Just to clarify, can you summarize what exactly the roles of a hotline worker would encompass?
Sure. So to be a hotline worker, you basically, you sign up and the hotline is broken into regions. And so when I have volunteered, I'm currently living in the DC area. And so I've been placed in the DC center. And so we receive calls from certain states. And as a worker, you get training. So you have to train for several hours before you can work. And then once you're a hotline worker, there are different guides that you can use. You will see that on the Election Protection website, they have resources for each state and the District of Columbia. And then there are also captains. So captains are experienced volunteers that can help you walk through issues or try to figure out what the answer is. As you've probably seen, election information can change rapidly due to litigation. And so even here where I live now in Virginia, there was a power outage on the very last day that people could register to vote here. And so a lawsuit was filed and the registration was extended by a day and a half, I believe. So basically as a hotline worker, you are answering phones, but you receive some training in advance. You have help from guidelines that have been created and help from more experienced volunteers.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. What resources are available to voters who want to ensure to exercise this right, that they can verify their vote was counted and was accurately put in the process?
Sure. So a great resource is the one that you all have been referring to, which is the 866ourvote.org. And so that is the organization that has the Election Protection Hotline, like I mentioned. Also, you've probably heard about When We All Vote. That's also a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that was co-founded by Michelle Obama. And they have a great resource that's called the Voting Resource Hub. And that is www.whenweallvote.org/VRH/. There you can do earlier in the election season, but you can definitely still check your registration. Depending on your state, you may be able to register to vote. You can request a ballot. You can edit your address. You can research your ballot. You can pledge to vote. You can know your rights as a voter. You can find your polling place. That's one of, so When We All Vote is one resource. Vote.org is another resource. You should also check the ACLU. So the ACLU.org, Know Your Rights. That is a website. On that specific website where it explains to you your rights as a voter. But there are a lot of different resources. The best resource is probably still your local Board of Elections website and your state of secretary, your Secretary of State's website. So that's on the front line information, especially in Florida. As you know, many things differ by county. And so you really want to check your county Board of Elections websites.
So after working with election protection and getting these firsthand accounts of the issues voters face, what do you think and what do you see needs to be done to help fix these issues on a government level?
Sure. I think that not just from working with election protection, but just my experience with voting. Like I said, I'm from Florida. I'm from Dade County, Florida. And so even my experience with voting has been different, especially now that I live in the DC area. So compared to in Florida, where I used to bring just like all of my documentation in case something happened. So my birth certificate, my social security card, a bill of some sort, my voter registration card, my ID. Here and in many other different states, you might be asked for your ID. You may just need to give your name. No matter where you are, you should bring all of your documents. But some of the things that I have seen that I think could help voting be more inclusive is mail-in ballots. That's not available everywhere. It's become more available during COVID-19, but that can help voting be accessible to people who may, you know, not be able to stand in long lines or may not be able to travel to their polling places. So mail-in balloting and making that more available would be a great way to make voting more inclusive. I would also say early voting centers, allowing people to early vote. Not everybody is able to vote on a Tuesday in November, especially during the workday. And so while you may have off to go and vote, depending on where you are, you still may need to be in line for 5, 6, 7 hours, unfortunately. So allowing early voting to be an option for people can be helpful, especially if they have expanded hours. So you may have people who need to vote really early in the morning or at night. That would also make voting more inclusive if we had early vote centers and expanded the hours. Also, same day registration. There are states, which I did not know because I'm from Florida, that have same day registration, not just for election day, but also during early voting. So if you miss, they still do the regular, you need to register to vote. But if for some reason you weren't able to register to vote, you can actually go in before voting and with the proper documentation, register to vote and then vote. So that would also make voting more inclusive, easy, and allow those to exercise the right that we have.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to quickly touch back on the election hotline service. Sure. So if I was someone who was looking into being a hotline worker, So what is the application process? What are the requirements? Like, what should I know as someone who wants to apply to be a hotline worker?
Sure. So for the hotline, most of the workers, from my understanding, are attorneys. But we did, personally, the National Bar Association Young Lawyers Division, that's part of our election, just all of our election work, voter registration, election protection, is working the hotlines. And so you can also be a law student or a legal professional. So a paralegal would be able to qualify for a hotline worker. Like I said, there are other roles. So if you are going to be like filing litigation, you would need to be a barred attorney, and not only a barred attorney, but barred in whatever area that litigation needs to be filed. So that has more requirements, but the hotline worker, usually they're attorneys, but you can be a law student, you can be a paralegal, legal professional.
Mm-hmm. And then, as a lawyer, you've had plenty of experience with election law, and you have an understanding of how decisions made by courts have impacted voters. So how have these court decisions both helped and hindered voter suppression attempts?
So I would say, at least for a lot of workers, unless you work for an entity like the ACLU or the NAACP, not many of us do election work. We do learn about it. You often learn about it in law school, in constitutional law, but as an attorney who now leads the Young Lawyers Division, it's important for me to know about, of course, any of the developments dealing with the election in 2020. So there are a few key cases that I would like for you all to know about. The first is Shelby County v. Holder. This is a really important case. The citation for it is 570 U.S. 529. It is a Supreme Court case that basically guts a part of the Voting Rights Act. And so to keep this short, the Voting Rights Act has a provision where historically, if there were areas that had issues with voting, likely due to race, these areas had to have pre-clearance in changing any of their voting laws. And so there is also a different part of the act that is the formula, where you had to, there's a formula to determine which areas fall under this preclearance requirement. In 2013, part of the act, section 4B, was deemed unconstitutional. And so after that was handed down, the additional oversight that many of these areas, particularly in the South, but there are other areas that it applied to, you saw an increase of different tactics. And so, for example, after Shelby County v. Holder, you saw their closing of polls that wouldn't have been necessarily allowed beforehand because you would have needed pre-clearance. Shortening of early voting days. So the same thing that I just mentioned before that would help voting be more inclusive. Under Shelby County v. Holder, some of these areas cut early voting days, and it was specifically because there are many groups who use early voting, specifically African Americans. On Sunday, there would be souls to the polls, and so people after church would go as a group to vote. These types of opportunities were cut short. Restrictions on how voter registration can be conducted. So you saw some of this in Florida when I was in school. I'm not sure about you all. We could register to vote. We registered to vote in school. So we registered to vote in AP government. And so for a while there were additional hoops you had to jump through if you wanted to help register people to vote that didn't exist pre Shelby County v. Holder. Efforts to keep returning citizens from voting. those have increased, and that will be something I talk about more. Gerrymandering under the 2020 census. The census has ended early. And as you know, due to a Supreme Court case that was handed down about 2 weeks ago. And so you can see there are some efforts dealing with redistricting that might be considered gerrymandering and issues with the Postal Service. We've seen that in previous years, that might have been an issue that was handled in a different way. But due to Shelby County, it is a lot easier to make these types of changes. The second case is North Carolina NAACP v. McQuarrie. That basically was a North Carolina case where the legislator decided that they were going to pass this gigantic elections law. And the law was meant to impose a strict photo identification requirement, but it also shortened early voting. It eliminated same day voter registration. These are same concepts I said that are making voting more inclusive. And it eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17 year olds, among other things. After a 3 year long battle, the Fourth Circuit actually determined that it was discriminatory to African Americans in violation of the Voting Rights Act. And so that was a case that, you know, in that instant, that law was not held up. And in the third case, which you all probably heard about, is Jones v. Governor of Florida, which came down September 11th. And that's an 11th Circuit case that dealt with returning citizens. So in 2018, the state of Florida, the people of Florida, passed Amendment 4, which allowed returning citizens to be able to vote. Most returning citizens to be able to vote. The legislator then passed a law that said the citizens needed to pay all their fees and fines. And that law was upheld in September. And so up until October 6th, people were attempting to, you know, pay fees and fines to be able to register to vote. And the Young Lawyers Division actually helped raise money to allow returning citizens to vote through the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. So those are just three examples of recent cases, but it's definitely an area that is developing after Shelby County.
Thank you so much for that informative segment. Now we just have one final question for you.
Sure.
What advice would you give to teens voting for the first time, worried about losing the importance of their vote?
I know it can be frustrating, and I know it seems like your vote doesn't count, but your vote really does count. There is so much power in being able to vote. And if you look at some of the numbers, for example, in 2016, 27,202 voters decided the election in Nevada. 131,000 people between the ages of 18 and 24 didn't vote. So your group, your age group in particular, you are important voters. Once you become 18 and you're allowed to vote, you have a voice, and collectively your vote can swing an election. So it may seem like, oh, I'm just one person, my vote doesn't matter. Your vote matters, and you should tell everyone and use any platform that you can, such as this wonderful podcast, to get your classmates, your friends, your cousins to understand the importance of voting.
Onika, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for the work you're doing to inform other people and protect voters and their rights. Before you leave, is there anything else you'd like to say to the people watching the Gradient podcast?
I just want to say I'm so honored to be with you all today. I think that you all are an excellent example, first of all, as Floridians. So as soon as I saw the email, I was like, oh, of course. But also from just everything that has gone on, and to show that it doesn't matter how old you are, you can be a leader and you can inspire people no matter your age. So I told some of my friends, hi Keila, hi Chanel, that I was coming on your show today and they are so jealous. So I just wanted to say great job. You all are doing amazing and it's very inspiring to be with you today.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so, so very much.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Williams, for your insight. And we'd like to thank all of you for watching this episode of the Gradient Podcast. And as we remind you at the end of every episode, if you're not already doing so, make sure you follow our Instagram here, our Facebook there, and our Twitter there. And specifically on our Twitter, we actually had a recent tweet where if you are a teen voter or even a new voter, we want to hear from you. So tweet at Gradient Podcast with the hashtag, #MyFirstTimeVoting to tell us about your experience.
That being said, we here at the Gradient Podcast are incredibly appreciative of our friends and support families outside of the podcast itself who have motivated us to become more politically active and have more information about the election and current affairs within the United States.
I know. Well, we really do prioritize the teen perspective here, but you definitely have to give thanks to, you know, the adults in our lives. Like my parents, they are a big push for me. They show me, you know, the importance in voting and the importance in exercising this privilege that we've been given. And I know the same goes for you too.
And finally, we want to give one last very special thank you to our 6 wonderfully amazing guests that we had that we were fortunate enough to have on our 2-part election special of the Gradient Podcast. These episodes could not have been done without you, and we want to once again thank you for your time. Us at the Gradient Podcast, and I'm sure all of our listeners were truly enjoyed having you on the podcast. So thank you once again.
To all the teens and voters watching our podcast, Election Day is November 3rd, so make sure you go out there and vote. You can use the great knowledge given to us by our experts to not only vote informed, but vote safely. So thank you so much for watching. Make sure to go and vote.
All that said, I'm Evan.
I'm Jaden.
And I'm Armand. Thank you.